Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the second day of November, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Hall. And any way you slice it, folks, we've got to begin this wrap-up of the week at this point by saying, hey, it's been quite a week. Not just the usual fake news, lies, and deep state machinations. We seem to have pushed the pedal to the metal when it comes to the Bolshevik drive to kick off Civil War 2.0, or Bolshevik Revolution 2.0. Same thing, take your pick. So let's start off our review of what's been going on with the big story of the week. Not really that new. We've seen this coming for a full 2 years. The only question was, did they even need an excuse to do it? Turns out the answer was no, much less evidence. But in a really sick, twisted kind of way, it certainly is apropos that they decided to do it on a pagan high holy day. And perhaps no surprise, the news, especially that dominated by the satanic left, seems to really fit the evil occasion. I mean, think about it. If you were a Baal-worshipping, Bolshevik revolution-pushing speaker for the commies, when would you schedule a sham impeachment vote? Especially given they obviously don't want to wait long enough for May Day or even Hitler's birthday. We'll get back to that farce in just a minute. But meanwhile, the financial markets for the first part of the week were pretty much in limbo too, awaiting the latest word from the godlike, or at least that's how they see themselves, presences on Mount Olympus, a.k.a. the Eccles Building at the Federal Reserve in Washington, District of Criminals. We're talking, of course, about the FOMC, the Fed's Open Market Committee. Even though what they were going to do was pretty much a lead pipe cinch, and everybody knew it, but they were waiting to see what the Fed would say about it. How well, in other words, would the Kool-Aid go down? Well, we'll get to all of that, and even some of the lower profile, but far more important stuff, too, as we recap the insanity for the week. So let's start here and get the obvious out of the way. The criminally evil, oath-breaking Congress voted along, what, party lines, at least almost precisely, to approve their sham impeachment resolution. They did everything but put on pumpkin heads and horns and sacrifice a goat on the burning embers of the Constitution to celebrate. And true to form, the Speaker for the Criminals, Nutcase Nancy Pelosi, made one of the most disgusting and absolutely historically and constitutionally illiterate, not to mention irreverent, statements prior to the slam-dunk sham vote Thursday morning I think we've ever heard. Quote, "This is something that is very solemn, that is something prayerful.
That's my story and I'm sticking to it."
And given the date and the lack of fealty to their oath before a different god that they obviously don't worship, does seem pretty obvious who or what they're praying to. Oh, and yeah, I did mention ignorant, so here's the rest of a quote. "What is at stake in all of this is nothing less than our," say it with me, folks, "democracy." And ironically, or maybe not, this is the very same woman who just about a week or so ago told the American people that their votes and what they wanted for don't matter a blankety-blankin' bit as to what they're going to do anyway. And Christine Lalala's coverage adds, that's not all. The sham that the Speaker for the Traitors presided over on Thursday, also called the Schiff Empowerment Act by those who know what's going on, was said by the lying speaker to give Republicans and the White House equal power with the crooked Democrats and their leader Adam Schiff for brains in the sham process. And you do have to admire the chutzpah here. How's that for a shameless, shiftless lie? And anybody that's even remotely been paying attention knows that was a whopper almost as big as everything else she's been up to lately. House Minority Whip Stephen Scalise on Thursday morning blasted the Soviet-style impeachment process spearheaded by the shiftless one and Pelosi and said that the president won't even be able to have his own legal counsel present during the so-called hearing. And the American people, of course, will be lucky if they get to hear anything that actually amounts to evidence as opposed to a pre-scripted slam dunk. The grade school level text of the so-called impeachment revolution, resolution approved by the socialist, was released Tuesday afternoon, and it further confirmed, according to just about every source your host has seen, that the far left here is simply attempting to remove Trump via a coup disguised as impeachment, since the coup disguised as a witch hunt fell on its face. Via Sean Davis in Red State, we have a couple of notes on the so-called impeachment resolution, and they kind of self-identify as lies. One of them is that Pelosi's resolution references, quote, the existing House of Representatives inquiry. But the problem is no such House of Representatives investigation or inquiry actually exists because the House never bothered to actually authorize one. And interestingly, neither does this resolution. And he notes, Democrats can't up and authorize a real investigation now because that would be an admission that their previous ones were in fact unauthorized, nuking their current case. So they have to play cutesy games where they reference a non-existent investigation and hope nobody will notice. And certainly that's true at least of the lapdog press. Among other travesties contained within the resolution, the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes, can only issue subpoenas, call in witnesses, and introduce genuine evidence with the permission of the almighty chairman, yeah, Adam Schiff for brains. In other words, he makes the rules, enforces the rules, and changes the rules whenever he feels like it. And I guess, folks, what that says is nothing really has changed here. Said White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham in a statement on Tuesday, the resolution put forward by Speaker Pelosi confirms that the House Democrats' impeachment has been an illegitimate sham from the start, as it lacked any proper authorization by a House vote. And then she went on to note that the White House is barred from participating at all until after Chairman You-Know-Who conducts two rounds of one-sided hearings to generate a biased report for the Judiciary Committee. And even then, the White House rights remain undefined, unclear, and uncertain because those rules still haven't even been written. And the official statement from the White House this morning followed that up by saying the president has done nothing wrong and the Democrats know it. Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats' unhinged obsession with this illegitimate impeachment proceeding does not hurt President Trump. It hurts the American people. And the statement concluded by noting that the whole sham we're seeing here is, quote, unfair, unconstitutional, and fundamentally un-American. But come on, folks, let's be real. That is, in fact, the intent, and that's been obvious from the get-go. We'll come back to the specifics of Bolshevik Revolution 2.0 and some of the other elements around the smokescreen in just a minute. But first, let's talk about the economic meltdown that is at least in part driving all of this, and some of the related things that you're not supposed to be paying attention to in the meanwhile. First, the obvious, everybody knew it was coming part. The Fed announced on Wednesday they would cut rates again by another 25 basis points, or 0.25%, to the 1.5% to 1.75% range, exactly as just about everybody had expected. It was the third straight reduction in the Fed funds rate, allegedly aimed at protecting the record-long U.S. expansion from all of the threats out there that might pop the biggest bubble in human history. But the Fed signals as well that they might pause before they get all the way to zero for now. And they've dropped the "we're going to act as appropriate" language or pledge that was once in their very verbose statement, signaling, well, at least maybe they're done cutting for now. And the change in all of the weasel wording was widely seen to be indicating a more hawkish stance going forward from the FOMC. Money manager, head of Pinto Portfolio Strategies, and Austrian economist Michael Pinto, who, like many, also saw this coming, appeared with USA Watchdog's Greg Hunter before the inevitable announcement, where he argued we're looking at yet another depression, and said, quote, that's why the Fed's panicking. If anybody still believes they're omniscient or omnipotent or know their butt from their elbow, that's over. And referring to the repo madness that's been going on for quite a while, and remember, folks, Fed Chair Powell has said, don't you dare call it QE. He added, it's not that it's QE, it's QE on steroids, he said. Everybody knows that this is QE. It's permanent, just like any banana republic would do, or has done. And he noted that given all the imbalances in the system, the Fed is well aware that the next recession won't be a mild one, so it has to keep pumping to avoid that, he would say, and I would agree, inevitable fate. The plunge in the stock market would be from a huge and much higher level, he said. Back in the Great Recession, unemployment claims spiked. We had millions of people laid off, and the same thing would happen today again, only much worse. Overnight, Michael Snyder at the Economic Collapse blog followed up with his analysis, basically asking, what in the world is the Federal Reserve thinking? Because as he began, you don't use up all of your ammunition before the battle even begins. Yes, he says the U.S. economy hasn't even officially entered recession territory yet, although many experts are definitely anticipating one by 2020. And when that recession arrives, the Federal Reserve is going to want as much ammunition to fight it as possible. Well, assuming, folks, they don't intend to really, truly stick a final pin in it this time. So he said, I was horrified to learn that the Federal Reserve announced on Wednesday that interest rates are being cut once again. We've now had three interest rate cuts in a row in 2019 as the Federal Reserve desperately attempts to revive the stalled U.S. economy, but what are they going to do during the next recession when they've already pushed interest rates all the way to the floor and they, well, at least the conventional wisdom goes, can't push them any lower? Maybe, your host interjects here, that's a question that kind of answers itself. And yes, he says, over recent days, the Fed's decided to absolutely flood the financial system with new money in a desperate attempt to stabilize the repo market. And in essence, they began launching a massive new round of quantitative easing even before. Although, remember, you're not allowed to call it that, even before a major crisis has erupted on Wall Street. And then he asks, along with others, are we destined to become the next Venezuela? Yeah, for a long time, he says, the Federal Reserve has insisted that the U.S. economy is in good shape. But if that's true, there's no way in the world the Fed should be cutting interest rates. Yet, that's exactly what they're doing, calling it yet another example of the incredibly short-term thinking that characterizes, even plagues, our society. He concluded, well, if they're this crazy now, what are they going to do when the real stuff hits the fan? And if we're looking at all the various stuff that's going on out there, folks, it's hard to imagine some of it at least not hitting multiple fans any time now. So with that in mind, we turn next to some of the other possibilities. Like this story from Judicial Watch about the invasion from the south. Mexico, it says, has seen an astounding 250% increase in Africans. Yeah, that's real Africans from the actual continent trying to enter the United States through the southern border. They come to Mexico first. How they get there, of course, given that they're supposedly refugees, is a tall question. But according to latest figures released by the Mexican government's immigration agency, Unidad de Política Migratoria, the stats include the first 8 months of 2019 and reveal that during the same period last year, 1,507 Africans were apprehended in that country, intending on heading to El Norte, and that compares with 5,286 this year. And during that same period, 4,783 migrants from India and Bangladesh also made their way through Mexico and managed to get caught. So you got to wonder how many didn't, according to data made public this month. And, of course, the information is alarming, notes Judicial Watch, considering that Africa and Bangladesh are hotbeds of terrorism and the fact that all of the migrants apprehended intended to head north into the United States. Quote, these migrants, although less in numbers compared to migrants from Central America, increased significantly in the country, said a Mexican newspaper article, confirming that their principal objective is, quote, not to stay in Mexican territory, but rather cross the border towards the United States. And, of course, the story also notes there are a whole bunch of Cubans, Haitians, and other South Americans, primarily from Brazil and Colombia, that have also been apprehended as they tried to make their way north. Judicial Watch concludes their piece on the continuing Islamic invasion of the southern United States by noting that such terrorists infiltrating their way into the country via Mexico really is nothing new. Many ISIS terrorists have been apprehended in the past, many more doubtless have not. And let's not forget, ISIS has a known training cell just a few miles from El Paso, Texas, too, in an area known as Anapra, situated just west of Ciudad Juarez in the Mexican state of Chihuahua. The People's Republic of California is, of course, not only a sanctuary state for any and all terrorists and Chinese communists that want to come in, along with Hollywood communists and all of those that they support. They also can't keep the state from burning, and they can't keep the lights on either. And yeah, more and more pundits have been pointing out that even though they keep turning off the power, that hasn't even seemed to have dented the continuing tendency of that state to flame on. DollarCollapse.com is one of several pundits and websites noting the parallels with communist Venezuela, saying Venezuela, too, has suffered through recurring power outages this year. They have a similar government, as money for routine maintenance dries up and power plant employees flee the country. And yeah, various cyber attacks aren't making the situation any better, and who knows which communist bloc those are coming from. Anyway, they note, a socialist Latin American country is expected to spend a fair bit of time in the dark while its impoverished citizens barter cigarettes for gasoline. In socialist California, of course, both of those things are politically incorrect, so the new arrivals assimilate to the culture, or is it vice versa, and learn to drop their needles in the poop they left on the street while they line up to get more free stuff. while it lasts. And here, the Dollar Collapse blog points out that NBC even is running headlines like this: Massive California Blackouts Could Become a Way of Life. Which prompts their headline, Welcome to the Third World, Part 30, As California Burns in the Dark. John Nolte, writing similarly for Breitbart, puts it this way: If California can't keep the electricity on, if California can't perform basic tasks like forest and brush management, if your once beautiful cities are now killing fields of human waste, needles, and the homeless, you're a failed state. So yeah, California is a failed state. A failed state is one that cannot deliver the basics: personal safety, adequate shelter, adequate transportation, and basic sanitation. Now here, your host interjects, arguably, California is not only not delivering those things, but trying explicitly to deprive once California citizens of exactly all of those things. Even New York City at its very worst was not as failed as the state of California is now. And as I write this, says Nolte, millions and millions of Californians who pay outrageously high taxes, and you have to ask what they're getting besides invaders for that, are having their electricity cut off for up to a full week because, one, California can afford to give illegal aliens free health care and welfare, but not to bury its power lines. Two, California can waste untold billions on so-called green energy boondoggles, but refuses to upset Mother Earth by implementing actual proven forest management techniques. And apparently, Mother Earth would rather burn than receive a brush cut. And he asks, I'm 53 years old, lived in rural areas most of my life. The longest I've ever seen the electricity out was 14 hours. Can you imagine being without electricity for 5 days? Well, folks, when communist Chinese-run Big Brother California gets their way, they'll do more than imagine it. They'll learn to live with it. Not all of them will, of course. One person's already been killed by these ridiculous blackouts, says John Nolte, a 67-year-old man who was dependent on oxygen. And still, that's not even the worst part of all of this, because even with the blackouts, yes, the state is still getting hammered by the deadly wildfires. Most discouraging, he says, is even the lack of anything that looks like a voter backlash. Well, actual voters as opposed to those that are being imported to continue the carnage. Concludes John Nolte, I mean, really, if more than 50% of California's so-called citizens are still willing to keep a government in power incapable of delivering even the basics, if they still prefer social justice over electricity, well, that's about the most pathetic thing I've ever seen. This is not how Americans are supposed to behave. And I think that's the point, don't you, folks? These are indeed, he says, sheeple. And, of course, the invasion vanguard. Charles Hugh Smith of Two Minds writes something very similar, as it turns out, but he takes the Chinese tack, asking, has California lost the mandate of heaven? Because in Chinese history, and if you think about it, that makes more and more sense when it comes to communist California, natural disasters were viewed as portents of the mandate of heaven, a.k.a. Tianmeng, or heaven's will, and that it's been withdrawn from the ruling dynasty. So you could broaden this concept a bit, and it does fit the new cultural context there, asking, has California too, and arguably their new masters, also lost the mandate of heaven? Because how many conflagrations does it take for it to sink in that the golden state is now the flaming state in some profoundly karmic fashion? How many messes of human excrement on our doorstep does it take to realize the situation ain't going to get any better, and it can only get worse from here, arguably much worse? How much gridlock traffic, how many power blackouts and mandatory evacuations does it take for those still in denial to accept that the mandate of heaven, Tianmeng, has been withdrawn? And just maybe, folks, that's a particularly appropriate musing for this not-so-particularly holy day as well. And one last observation on this front. And here your amateur radio aficionado host has to note that, yeah, we understand the value of amateur radio communications and things like repeaters in remote areas, which have been for a long, long time now the bulwark, the backup for communications options like cell towers and the internet. Because hams have a long experience with emergencies and natural disasters and how to provide communications in spite of things like hurricanes, forest fires, and floods, and especially that includes power outages, Which brings me to this interesting piece from The Organic Prepper, headlined, Communications Are Down in Parts of California. Radio, TV, Internet, cell towers fall victim to PG&E blackouts as wildfires rage. Yes, it begins, and you knew this, California is burning, and the planned power outages initiated by Pacific Gas and Electric, the infamous PG&E, have understandably enraged a lot of residents, particularly due to an unintended, well, no, I would say absolutely intended, maybe unexpected by the masses, consequence. The blackouts have cut power to many cell phone towers, leaving lots of folks without access to vital information. Furthermore, it says, impacted residents are also without television and the internet, and 26 radio stations were out of service as well, further limiting emergency communications. And without cell service, they're learning, signing up for emergency wildfire evacuation notices or using backup chargers to keep your cell phones going during a power outage is pretty much useless. The San Francisco Chronicle reported that on Tuesday, nearly 250,000 customers across the state were without communication services, TV, internet, and phone, according to data that companies reported to the Federal Communications Commission. And that number was down from almost 500,000 the day before. And of course, when cell service is down, so is the ability to call 911. The story goes on at some length, says Chris Ungson, Deputy Director for Communications and Water Policy for the California Public Advocates Office. There's an irony for you. Quote, you don't appreciate how essential cell phone service is until you lose it. It's not, he continued, just a matter of inconvenience. It's a matter of public health and safety. It's a lifeline to many, many people. Unquote. And hey, folks, maybe that explains why the communist state of Chinese-run California was so insistent to get those evil amateur radio repeaters that provided not only local communications but vital emergency backup out of all of those wilderness and off-grid areas where they wanted to make sure people, well, suffered exactly like this. Almost, folks, as if somebody evil, was planning on it. I'll ask the question I've asked many times before. Is it fair to ascribe to conspiracy that which can be explained by incredible, massive stupidity? Answer? Only when it begins to look like nobody, even an occasional cortex, could be quite that stupid. Evil, though, as we're seeing, is another thing entirely. I don't have much time to spend on the blithering idiot masquerading as a military lieutenant colonel, Alexander Vindictive, or Vindman, who supposedly listened in on the president's call to the Ukrainian president and then tried and failed to tamper with the rough draft of it, and who, according to Devin Nunes, was literally coached by Adam Schiffless through his so-called impeachment testimony earlier in the week. As part of the theater, he showed up in full military uniform, even though others have reported NSC staff, which is what he is, aren't supposed to wear them. So why did he turn up that way, as if we didn't know? During questioning, he not only admitted he'd tried to edit the documents, must think he's an FBI agent, but he'd shared the readouts of the call with several other secret operatives. And when Representative Jim Jordan tried to ask him who, the shiftless one shut down the entire line of questioning, prompting Devin Nunes to note he'd never seen anything like it in my entire life. Quote, it was unprecedented. I mean, they've been bad at most of these depositions, but to interrupt us continually to coach the witness, unquote, well, that's something else. And furthermore, folks, this witness seemed most upset that the president would dare to try and investigate a crime by Joe and Hunter Biden. And basically, the idiot was incensed that a foreign government would be asked to spy on an American citizen. As if an NSC employee could be such a blithering idiot as to be ignorant of what the Five Eyes is all about. Which leads me to another story, same topic, same kind of lying scumbag people, that really does summarize where the coup is at this weekend. Thank God for the deep state, says a headline courtesy of Zero Hedge, Steve Watson at Summit News, and the like. Intel traitors admit their goal is to take out a duly elected president. During an interview with Margaret Brennan of C-SPAN, former CIA head John McLaughlin, along with his successor, the beyond traitorous John Brennan, both basically admitted there really is a secretive cabal of people within the U.S. intelligence community who are literally trying to take Trump out. Crowed McLaughlin as the liberals in the crowd cheered, thank God for the deep state. Of course, we know, folks, he's talking about a different God than the one that wrote the Bible. He went on to say that the line of traitors traipsing up to Capitol Hill to test a lie before the slam-dunk impeachment railroad are, quote, responding to a higher call. Perhaps even worse, if that's possible, Brennan, who's openly been caught lying under oath before Congress, was shameless enough to actually praise other traitors who are, quote, standing up and carrying out their responsibilities, unquote, and essentially to undermine an elected president. But note this, folks. They're no longer even trying to hide the existence of the deep state, who they really work for, or what they intend to do to the republic. We'll be right back.
When I think back on all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all. And my lack of education hasn't hurt me none. I can read the writing on the wall. Cold or thrown.
My love, take my land, take me where I cannot stand. I don't care, I'm still free. You can't take the sky from me. Take me out to the black, tell them I ain't coming back. Burn the land and boil the sea. You can't take the sky from me.
Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. This is still your host, Mark Hall, and we're still talking about insanity being passed off as news in a formerly free constitutional republic and just how far we've come. Let's start off this segment with something truly scary. Just to set the stage, Hillary Clinton trying to teach scripture. All right, twisting it. Even if it is also more than a bit, vomitrocious. Because, yeah, as we know from the 80-20 rule, some of what she said was actually true. So here goes.
It is no coincidence, is it, that Elijah Cummings shared a name with an Old Testament prophet, whose name meant in Hebrew, "The Lord is my God," and who used the power and the wisdom that God gave him to uphold the moral law that all people are subject to.
Whoa, that deserves a minute or seven of silence. Or is she really just saying, you people? Because obviously some of us are more like gods than you people. And trivial things like thou shalt not steal, and especially thou shalt not murder, obviously don't apply to us. So let's try to hold down our dinners and take another pass at that.
And who used the power and the wisdom that God gave him to uphold the moral law that all people are subject to, and because of all people are equal.
You see, that was clever. It's not what it says, not even really that close. We're created in his image. We may even, if you go with the founder's vision, which she obviously doesn't, have been created equal, and are supposed to be equal under the law. And how's that for a whopper revealed? And come to think of it, even that old saying from 100 years ago comes a lot closer to being actually scriptural than what Hitler is trying to peddle here. It went something like this. God created man. Sam Colt made him equal. The truth is that when Hitler and her Ahab-style pagan state take power, and everyone else is disarmed, the intent is for her deplorable subjects to be equally enslaved. But we're still working up to the truly biblical-style whoppers.
Like the prophet, our Elijah could call down fire from heaven.
But unlike the prophet of Yah, Elijah used that power on his behalf to destroy the evil priests of Baal, a fake god. And he knew Jezebel for what she was, a spectacularly evil servant of that fake god.
But he also prayed and worked for healing. He weathered storms and earthquakes, but never lost his faith. Like that Old Testament prophet, he stood against corrupt leadership of King Ahab and Queen Jezebel.
And you know what, folks? I left that response in just to show you the depth of the deception at play here. And I guess just to set the really twisted record here straight, what I ought to do is read from the actual story as opposed to the satanically twisted version that you just heard a tiny out-of-context piece of. For starters, here's the real parallel. When the prophet Eliyahu, whose name really means Yahuwah is my El, or my God, stood before the real nasty king, Ahab, Ahab too tried to pull a Hitlery, in other words, blaming what he's been doing on his adversaries, and pretend that he was the good guy and that the prophet was the bad guy, saying, "Is that you, O troubler of Israel?" To which Eliyahu replied, and by the way, this is from 1 Kings chapter 18, "I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have, and it's you that have forsaken the commandments of Yahuwah and have followed after the Baals, the fake gods." Which, of course, no surprise here either, was primarily Jezebel's doing. And Eliyahu issued his famous challenge. "Therefore, go and gather all Israel up to be on Mount Carmel, the 450 prophets of Baal, and the 400 prophets of Asherah, and basically we'll just see who the real God is." I guess today the analogy would be 435 prophets of Baal and 100 prophets of Asherah. And no, folks, nothing even remotely close to that has yet happened in the district of Criminal Swamp. But here's the crux of the whole story. Eliyahu, Elijah, came to all the people, and he said, "How long will you falter between two opinions? If Yahuwah is God, then follow him. But if it's Baal, then follow him." But the people didn't cheer and scream like they did for Queen Hitlery. Instead, the Bible says in verse 21 here, they answered him not a word. Well, that is, until the real prophet of Yah called down real fire from the real heavens, the people figured out who the real God was and killed all of those prophets of Baal. And notice that Hitlery didn't choose to talk about that part of the story, much less what happened to Queen Jezebel a bit later on. And while we're on this track, I guess this is a good story to continue the theme with. Freshman Representative Katie Hill, communist from the People's Republic of California, is resigning amid a probe by the, are you ready for this? I didn't know they still had this, the House Ethics Committee, in allegations that she had a sexual relationship, think Me Too, but sometimes it actually applies to the far left even, with a staffer. Those were followed by leaked naked pictures that she actually threatened to sue the UK's Daily Mail and other publications concerning. "It is with a broken heart," said the 32-year-old sexual predator, "that I today announce my resignation from Congress." In what Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge called an unnecessarily lengthy statement by the once-rising Democrat star, quote, "This is the hardest thing I've ever had to do." And somehow, folks, I have little doubt that at least that part is true. All right, back to the quote. "But I believe it is the best thing for my constituents, my community, and our country," unquote. And now if about 300 more would follow her lead, that would truly be great. But don't hold your breath, obviously. Interestingly, one of the many naked pictures posted online by the former Congress critter showed her posing naked, smoking a bong, before it was legal in California. But who's surprised by hypocrisy anymore? Still, though, just wait. And here's the part of the lengthy, sordid story that your host at least found most interesting. A tattoo in the photo near her pubic area, they note, could open the Congress critter to accusations of hypocrisy. Gee, do you think? Because it looks a lot like a Nazi-era cross. Because she has previously criticized so-called racist Facebook posts that included similar-looking crosses, including one posted by a Santa Clarita veteran who was featured in her political rivals' campaign advertisements last year. Which prompted the hypocrite to call out the veteran, saying the post left her, quote, "deeply disturbed," and adding that his, quote, "hateful rhetoric helped fuel violence across America," unquote. And there's this bit of precious irony in the story, too. Said Hill, in her resignation manifesto, "having private photos of personal moments weaponized against me," remember, folks, she posted a lot of these on socialist media herself, "has been an appalling invasion of my privacy," unquote. And gee, some would say that's true of all kinds of traitors trying to undermine an elected presidency. But back to the irony here. She added, "it's also illegal, and we are currently pursuing all of our available legal options," unquote. Well, folks, so is sexual harassment of a congressional staffer on your team. if you're a deplorable anyway. All of which might lead one to believe, that is, if they don't get their Bible instruction from Team Jezebel, or Hitlery, that you really do reap what you sow, because there really is a God, and he really does have a sense of humor. And occasionally even, especially if we're paying attention, the truth actually comes out. Case in point, from Joe Hoft at the Gateway Pundit, the corrupt and criminal deep state set up, as if we didn't know this for quite a while now, General Flynn, and then used that fraudulent crime, in turn, to try to set up President Trump. And it begins by noting that, as Breitbart reported yesterday, a multifaceted criminal conspiracy to destroy former National Security Advisor General Michael Flynn was launched by persons across the national security state apparatus to prevent audits of intelligence agencies' operations, said Lee Smith, author of a book called The Plot Against the President, the true story of how Congressman Devin Nunes uncovered the biggest political scandal in U.S. history. He appeared in a Friday interview on SiriusXM's Breitbart News Tonight with host Rebecca Mansour and special guest host Rick Manning. And at this point, Hoft includes a comment from the well-connected Colonel Tony Schaefer, who says, "I know for a fact that Mike Flynn had directed a 100% review of all intelligence and special operations, and there's no doubt what he would have found. The Soviet-level wrongdoing we're now all aware of, and basically, the obvious implication is, he had to be stopped." And if you think back to Obama's comments about how he wanted Flynn stopped when he met with Trump on Inauguration Day, well, all of the pieces begin to fall into place. Michael Flynn simply needed to be gotten rid of by any means necessary, and before the insurance policy could be circumvented up front. The story continues by noting that last week, General Michael Flynn's attorney, Sidney Powell, released her filings to the court, and that filing is damning to the various deep state players who work so deviously to set up General Flynn, because it's clear that, as requested by Powell, General Flynn's case must be dismissed, if we still had a rule of law, based on the many crimes committed by the government in order to set him up. Technofog was the first on the Internet to release and analyze the various documents, including the infamous Lisa Page-edited Flynn 302. The documents also included the evil James Clapper telling a WAPO reporter named Ignatius to basically, quote, take the kill shot on Flynn. Powell then describes how the Flynn 302 was altered some 2 weeks as well after the actual interview, noting that they added some stuff, including a description of Kislyak and any Russian response to the request from Flynn, which prompted Powell to explain, quote, that question and answer do not appear in the agent's notes. She also noted in a footnote that James Clapper was related to the illegal leaking of General Flynn's phone call with Russian Ambassador Kislyak, as has been noted separately. And on the 26th page of the document, Powell states that the government's case against Flynn is, quote, so fundamentally unfair as to be shocking to the universal sense of justice. Well, which doesn't seem to exist anymore on the floor of Congress. And may, we're seeing demonstrated now, never have existed on the 7th floor of the FBI J. Edgar Hoover building. Attorney Powell also asserts that the government has the original 302s, and that's the only record, folks, of an interview that the FBI never bothers to record, evidently so they can do things like this. And she notes that the FBI system simply doesn't lose those documents. The only way they could be lost, kind of like emails and disk drives, is through tampering. And it seems clear the government doesn't want to provide them because it's clear they would exonerate Flynn, and then it would be game over for the deep state. Well, at least game over on this front. No doubt, as nutcase Nancy Pelosi has pointed out, they've got a million other things to go after the president for, even if they have to keep making them up. Hoff goes on to recap a whole bunch more of this sordid story, noting that TGP had reported back on August 3rd that less than a month after the Mueller special counsel operation was created, the Mueller gang was already working on their obstruction efforts against the president, to which the Comey memos they demonstrated were key to the Mueller obstruction trap, per Representative Nunes, and they too were likely edited by none other than the chief whoremeister, Comey himself. Says Hoft, at the time of the president's initial meeting with the scumbag Comey, both the president and General Flynn had no idea of the extent of the actions that led to the general being set up, because they believed General Flynn had committed no crime, and in hindsight, maybe at the time they could be excused for thinking that actually mattered, and they didn't know that Flynn was found innocent of any wrongdoing, related to his call to the Russian diplomat even before the inauguration, as noted in an FBI memo that they, of course, weren't allowed to see, and which still, to this day, has never been provided to General Flynn. Do you get the idea, folks, just how crooked this whole stinking scam really is? The president obviously didn't know that the FBI director, Hormeister Comey, was spying on him and recording his supposed interactions in various memos, and neither did he nor General Flynn know that they were being spied on by the deep state in London via multiple spies, including Mifsud and Halper, in a dinner with the Russian President Vladimir Putin, and neither of them knew the full extent that they were being spied on as well over the prior few years by the Obama regime. Concludes the piece, the deep state simply set up General Flynn and then used that illegal spying effort and fraudulent crime to attempt to remove President Trump from office, an election, of course, which they had an insurance policy in mind to circumvent from the get-go. Breitbart News this week reprinted an excerpt from Sebastian Gorka's new book called The War for America's Soul, Donald Trump, the Left's Assault on America, and How We Take Back Our Country. Which really does seem quite appropriate, given the other news of the day. America and her allies, he begins, may have defeated the deadly totalitarian regimes of National Socialism and Fascism in World War II and Communism in the Cold War, but neither ideology is dead. In fact, Communism is very, very much alive today, and I'm not referring to North Korea, China, or Cuba. Yes, they're all Communist regimes which have survived the fall of the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union. But what I'm talking about is the Communist and Socialist threat inside America. A threat that has internalized key elements of fascism to boot. We may have won the Cold War with the Soviet Union and its slave satellites, but 30 years later, the internal threat from those who wish to dismantle our nation from the inside is greater than it's ever been since the Civil War. Consider this, he says. Today in America, one of the two parties which divide power between themselves is most often represented by a group of freshman congresswomen, the so-called Squad. He leaves out the word I think is appropriate, the Jihad Squad, although he says, I instead prefer the four horsewomen of the Democrat apocalypse, made up, of course, of the occasional Cortex, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and Ayanna Pressley. Two of those women are actually members of the Democratic Socialists of America, and they were elected openly to office as such, and together, these four, who have within the space of less than 6 months managed to box the establishment Democrats, including their titular leader, Nancy Pelosi, into an irrelevant corner, have openly, either individually or as a group, espoused all of the following extreme stances. And I probably won't list the entire half a page or so here, but let's hit some of the highlights. They've demanded the dissolution of ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, and the Department of Homeland Security, but not because it's too totalitarian, mind you. They've advocated open, unsecured borders with Mexico. What could possibly go wrong? They've supported taxpayer-funded so-called health insurance for any and all illegal aliens who can make their way across that open border. They've called the DHS holding facilities for illegal immigrants concentration camps. No doubt they intend to use them against actual Americans, which was probably the real reason they were built in the first place. They've gone on to talk about so-called queer voices, and even the fact that none of those so-called voices are still allowed to dissent from their socialist agenda. They've described the horrendous attacks of September the 11th, 2001, as, quote, some people did something. They've refused to denounce violent acts of Antifa, Al-Qaeda, or ISIS, but do not only denounce nonviolent acts, but the actual speech of anybody else who stands against them. Yes, they've proposed their idiotic so-called Green New Deal, and so forth. And this, he says, is just a fraction of the outrageous things that the Jihad Squad have accomplished since the 2018 elections. How did we get here, he asks. How did these women, with their anti-Semitic, un-American, outright socialist views, and extremist identity politics, become the face of what was once called the Democrat Party? Well, he says it was no accident. Here we could spiral down a rabbit hole of historic investigation, but I'll be as succinct and as operational as I can be, mindful of the fact that all you need right now are the most pertinent facts that will arm you in your political fight to support the Make America Great Again agenda and help secure the future of our nation. And at least he's optimistic enough to suggest it's not already too late. When he continues, he says the fundamentals here are clear enough. The new left in America can trace their genetic roots back to Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who almost single-handedly upended centuries of Western philosophical and theological wisdom. Because instead of believing that man is fallen, fatally flawed, and prone to selfishness and evil, Rousseau denied the reality of thousands of years of human history and posited that man was inherently good, and that his goodness could be maximized if we turned away from the idea of old trivial things like individual rights, liberties, and duties, and instead focused on the communal will of the people, where the good of the whole world would outweigh that of the individual. Yes, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, Star Trek told us, and that we could socially engineer a better society. Rousseau's vision was central to Karl Marx's subsequent development of the collectivist ideology of communism. And like an ideological scrapbooker, Marx picked and purloined the ideas of others to build his philosophy, taking the ideas of the perfectibility of man and communalism from Rousseau. He stole the idea of historical materialism from Friedrich Engels, lifted the idea of inevitable progress, in Marx's vision, that's communism, from Hegel and his infamous dialectic, you know, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And the upshot was that Marx was able to take Hegel's profoundly religious concept and utterly remove God and truth, and thus was born dialectic materialism, in which the thesis and antithesis were expressions of the inherent conflict within society, the clash between the haves and have-nots, the oppressor and the oppressed, the capitalist and the exploited workers, the proletariat, all of which would result in a final revolution and the communist ideal. Says Gorka, no, seriously, this garbage is what Karl Marx sold within his books Das Kapital and the Communist Manifesto, and incredibly, some people believed this rubbish, and more so now, folks, that they've been dumbed down in the public cesspools, especially since they're generally ignorant of the history that Gorka then proceeds to outline. Since then, it's been used as a blueprint to sabotage and subvert a number of nations around the world, starting with Tsarist Russia, stretching all the way to Cuba and China. But the trouble is, everywhere it's been tried, Marx's followers have failed. And as Andrew Breitbart points out, America proved to be an especially tough nut for Marx's followers to crack because of how our nation was born. Our founding fathers knew and wrote full well that man has fallen and tends towards the selfish and the bad. That's why they put all kinds of restraints, impediments in the way towards democracy, which they referred to correctly as the devil's own government. They understood the necessity, says Gorka, of having a government with checks and balances and a separation of powers, and they bequeathed to us a written constitution founded not on some absurd utopian collectivist vision of society, but built on the recognition of unalienable God-given rights, including the rights guaranteed to us, protected by the Bill of Rights. Which brings us to a hunchback Italian cripple named Antonio Francesco Gramsci, the godfather of all that threatens modern America and our freedoms today, from the occasional Cortex's Green New Deal to the violence of Antifa. His writings, penned from an Italian prison cell, were based on the conviction that communism had failed in established Western democracies, as opposed to the backward and mostly peasant society of Tsarist Russia, because those societies were still too resilient and too developed to fall victim to what they were pushing. So they needed to be dismantled instead, piece by piece, from the inside. And the new left has now taken that realization and fashioned it into a political platform that forms the Democrat Party's Articles of Belief. From the Obamacare unprecedented intrusion into private health care choices to a continuing litany of anti-scientific insanities, from climate change BS to transgenderism and beyond. Institutionally, he continues, the story moves from here to Germany and a wealthy philosophical playboy named Felix Weil, who used his family's wealth to make a home for these radical ideas under the name of the Institute for Social Research. But turns out you've probably heard of this institute by its other name, based on where it was founded, the Frankfurt School, and its collection of lethal ideas which now dominate American colleges. The Frankfurt School cohorts recognized that Marxism would never prevail against established and robust developed societies because the status quo in the West was simply immune to radical ideas of so-called social justice and equality enforced by the almighty state. So they came up with an otherwise inoffensive-sounding weapon to destroy the status quo, critical theory, which now seems to dominate the social sciences across America and most of the Judeo-Christian world. And it says that the current state of affairs must be relentlessly challenged on all fronts, because power is in the hands of those who, unlike them, of course, don't deserve it. And all standing relationships and all dominant concepts must be criticized and dismantled, even language itself, until modern society lies deconstructed and in pieces, incapable of defending itself from being rebuilt along Marxist lines. The Frankfurt School recruited names now idolized by the left, including Herbert Marcuse and Erich Fromm. And with the rise of the Nazis, even though they were ideological kin, many were still Jewish. They moved to America and found homes in places like Princeton, Columbia, Brandeis, and the University of Chicago, where they wormed their way into American society, starting with journalists like Edward R. Murrow and moving to incredibly influential cultural actors like Dr. Benjamin Spock. Marcuse himself, ever a fan of Nazi methodologies, began to espouse a style of totalitarianism disguised as tolerance, partisan tolerance. And here we're almost out of time, folks, but if you've been following what's happened to what was once called free speech, you can see exactly what partisan tolerance, Orwellian style, really means. So try to speak up while you still can, because if you don't know your rights, obviously you're not going to have any.